Hello, this is the Media Report on RN. I'm Richard Adie. This week, 1 year after Guardian Australia's launch, it's editor Catherine Viner on the good, the tough, and what's next. As you're probably aware, the New York Times, which is arguably the most important newspaper in the world, last week sacked its editor, Jill Abramson. She was the first woman in the role. As a result, perhaps as a protest, perhaps to cause trouble, perhaps simply because it was felt to be the right time, somebody leaked an internal report, and it's dynamite. Although Jill Abramson's sacking has garnered more headlines, the report looks at something much more fundamental, and that's the whole approach to going digital, turning America's paper of record into a dynamic, always relevant digital presence that readers can access however they want and tailor to their needs. To be fair to the New York Times, it's been pretty good at some of this, if not up there with the real leaders. There's a lot in the report, but it adds up to a series of cultural problems inside one of the world's leading news outlets. Joshua Benton is the director of Harvard's Nieman Journalism Lab.
I think it's important both for the Times and for the broader media world because the Times is a leader. It's you know, arguably the best newspaper in the world, one of the best digital news sites in the world as well. And to see some place that was so advanced have so many of these cultural problems and so many of the sort of attitudinal issues that have prevented a full level of success online is kind of remarkable. I mean, whatever you read that's happening at the Times, you can probably be sure that some version of it is happening at a lot of other newspapers and broadcasters around the country and the world.
Yes. Actually, you just made a point that we should highlight early on. The problems the Times has are cultural. Their communications internally. It's not about resources, is it, Josh?
Well, that's always a problem with newspapers these days. They have less of it than they used to. But on the business side, the Times has held up relatively well. So it's not as if they are scrounging around for change in the seat cushions of their couch. They have resources. They have hundreds of people working on technology and design and development. You know, many teams of engineers working on apps and other things that are really high quality. It is really, I think, fundamentally about the culture shift that comes when an institution that was really, really good at doing things one way has to shift that. It's a model of disruption that you see across lots of industries. It's even though the people who run the Times are really excellent journalists, it still takes a cultural shift to be able to make that work in a different medium.
Mm. Well, let's talk about some of the key issues that Nieman Lab highlighted when the report came out. And the first thing that struck me was that the value of the homepage is decreasing and decreasing. And this is critical because not just the Times, but essentially news and media outlets everywhere keep trying to push people towards their homepage.
Yeah, so people who go to your homepage frequently, they're wonderful. You like to have them. It's not something you want to discourage. But increasingly, people are coming across news at the individual article level. They see a link on Facebook. They see a link on Twitter. They hear about a specific article and go straight there, as opposed to starting at the front of the website, seeing the news as the editors want it to be presented at that particular moment, and navigating from there. But the Times still has actually a very homepage-centric audience compared to many other outlets. So the Times has somewhere between a third and a half of their visits starting on the homepage. For an outlet like The Atlantic, the American magazine that has really done a terrific job in creating a digital culture, it's about 12%. And for the site that I run at NiemannLab.org, it's only about 6%. The traffic comes through social media, comes through the side door, and that means you have to present the news in a different way.
You mentioned traffic coming from social, and there is a telling statistic in that report about how little of the Times traffic comes through social compared to someone like BuzzFeed, where they get 60-odd% through social.
Yeah, the Times only gets around 10% or so, most of that from Facebook, a smaller amount from Twitter. Yeah, and one of the things they cite in there is that the Times had a really big, really excellent report about a poor girl who lived in New York. It was very beautifully reported, beautifully illustrated, summed up all the resources that the Times had. When it went online, the reporter who wrote the story didn't tweet it for 2 days, didn't do anything to promote it online. One of the other findings in the report was that there are individual reporters and editors at the Times who understand social media and understand the value of promoting your work and using social media as a tool. But it's often people who learn that when they published a book, or they wrote a book, and their publisher, their book publisher, said, you really have to get on social media. It wasn't the newspaper that led them to do that. When you're at the Times, you're expecting that your work is going to reach a big audience because it's the New York Times. You may not be thinking, I need to go, you know, hustle a little bit to build that audience.
Yeah, and in fact, there's some telling comparisons about this. So they looked at ProPublica, where reporters have to submit 5 possible tweets when they file a story, and that editors have a meeting to kind of look at social media for every story package. Now, the Times doesn't do that.
Yeah, you do see throughout the report a model in which the print publication schedule and the print modality is the dominant cultural force. I mean, it spends a lot of time, for example, talking about the role of page one, figuring out what are going to be the 6 or so stories that you're going to be presenting to the world as the most important things to know about right now. That's a process that involves a morning meeting, an afternoon meeting, editors who could be doing other things instead prepping their pitches for those meetings so they can try and get their reporter stories on page one. It basically means that for the entire work day, that's a process that's aimed towards producing stories that are going to come out in the evening and be posted often late in the evening. Mm. The problem is the Times' audience isn't reading the site that much at 11 p.m. It's not the peak time. The peak time is probably 9 a.m. or 9 to 10 or so. That's when there's a lot of audience, but they're not really producing much content because they just have yesterday's news, which was posted about 8 or 10 hours earlier. So the schedules, you know, print just requires a certain kind of rhythm and doesn't line up well with the needs for digital.
No, indeed. The other thing that struck me is about personalization of content. What does the report tell us about how much the Times has decided it actually wants to do here?
That's something that is another cultural issue. So the Times believes, and I think this is an accurate belief, that a lot of their readers go to the Times because they want to trust the Times' judgment about what's important. If the Times thinks a story is important, they want to know that. They like the idea of a packaged bundle. Mm. You know, that was the only way you could get it in print, but there's a significant chunk of the audience that really wants that. You know, the New York Times knows a lot about the kinds of stories that I'm interested in. They actually have a recommendation engine that's actually pretty good. You know, I read several hundred Times stories in a given month, and on the front page, it tells me these are stories you might be interested in, and they're usually pretty accurate. But they're not willing to make that part of the top of the homepage. It's sort of buried a little bit. It's not the main focus of attention because they're torn between this, we are telling you what the news is, to we produce 300 stories a day. We know that most people are never going to read anything but a tiny fraction of those. Maybe we can do a better job of lining up someone's interest with a story we've produced that can meet that interest.
Yeah, because one thing that's mentioned in about the same place is that they did look at and they could do perhaps a follow button. So every time somebody writes a column who you like that columnist or you're interested in that topic, you could just get a notification.
Right, exactly. And this goes beyond the Times. I mean, with the role that social networks play in allowing us to figure out what we're interested in, to curate the list of people that we follow, the pages that we like on Facebook, to create a news product that is curated for my interests, that's just a huge dynamic. And it's one that is not just hurting the Times, it's hurting just about everyone else who is a traditional media company that thinks we're producing a package of content every day.
Josh, a lot of the report addresses issues that the average reader isn't going to think about, but that actually has a huge impact on how the reader uses the New York Times. So things like, and this is pretty basic, tagging and structuring their data. They've got a long way to go on this.
And what's ironic there is that the New York Times was for decades the absolute unquestioned leader in this. If you went to a public library or a research library in the United States 20 years ago, if you went to the research desk, you would find what was called the New York Times Index. It was a printed book that actually contained a very detailed, nicely cross-referenced index of everything that had been printed in the New York Times that year. It's a tremendous resource that they started making back in the 1920s that really helped establish the New York Times as the paper of record in the United States. But despite that wonderful history and that legacy, a lot of the ways that they currently tag up stories and annotate them for internal or external use is based on that old print paradigm of those reference books. They haven't really updated it much. And that's difficult if you want to, say, for example, be smarter about automatically connecting one story to another. That's one thing that sort of tagging and metadata can do. It can also be really useful in figuring out what's working on your own website. For example, if you had a way to tag all the stories that you had that had an embedded video in them, mm-hmm. you could figure out, well, do those stories do any better than the ones that don't have a video? Is it worth putting that video in there? If you could do these sorts of large-scale tests to see what your audience is interested in, you could optimize to do more stuff that's going to, you know, please your readers more. But you need to have the data to be able to make those sorts of analyses.
There's almost a list of the missed opportunities on tagging. So apparently it took 7 years to start tagging the stories connected with September 11. They didn't set up a tag for the Benghazi terrorist attack a few years ago. So that's something that's awfully difficult to go back and do afterwards.
One of my favorites was that they had for apparently decades wanted to have some sort of product that would take advantage of the fact that the New York Times has been publishing recipes for a very long time. They have this incredible store of recipes that you could imagine some people being interested in maybe paying for. The Times has since launched a cooking product that's in beta currently. But they couldn't really build that product because they had no metadata that would allow them to figure out which recipes had olives in them and which recipes were Italian and which ones were French. That they didn't have the data around it, so they actually ended up having to pay an outside firm to go through and determine all these metadata elements for all their recipes.
Well, one thing that really emerges are the divides, despite the best of intentions. There's seemingly a divide between the editorial side and the business side. There's a divide between what I might just call the traditional journalists and the digital people.
Yeah, I think that's true. And, you know, the divide between the business side and the newsroom was traditionally something that was very much valued. You know, newspaper reporters would be proud of the fact that they knew nothing about how the business worked. And, you know, you can do that when the business is going fine. It's not going as fine anymore. So there are a lot of cases detailed in the report where the newsroom side would be building a product that they didn't really have any idea whether there was not a potential audience for. And the business side people had data to illustrate that, but they weren't talking to each other. Even within the newsroom, even forgetting the business side for a minute, there's a significant analytics team that knows an awful lot about how different stories perform on the New York Times website. What are the kinds of things people want to read at certain times of the day? What's the best way to get one story promoted to a large audience? But there often is a big disconnect between those analytics people and the journalists, the editors, and the reporters, so they're not able to benefit from that knowledge.
Yeah, Josh, this report shows that the New York Times has known that it has problems, and it spent months trying to work out what these problems are and how it could resolve them. What do they do next?
Well, you know, the other big story that everyone's been talking about at the Times is the recent change in editorial leadership. I think that in the Times, Jill Abramson, who was fired last week for unrelated matters, was generally viewed as an improvement over her predecessor in terms of digital savvy. It wasn't her total focus, and she didn't get total applause for it, but better than her predecessors. The new editor, Dean McKay, is beloved by the newsroom and is known as a great reporter and a great editor and a great manager, but not necessarily known as a digital person. You know, there was much remarking that he has a Twitter account and he's never tweeted or followed anybody from it. No, that doesn't. Having a Twitter account is not the definition of what makes you a good editor or anything like that. That's way too simplistic. But it would be nice once and again for there to be someone who does have some sort of interest in those sorts of digital platforms. So that's a piece of it. I think what's important about this report is that it was initially distributed to only a small set of newsroom leaders. It was not distributed to the entire newsroom. It was only after it was leaked to the outside world that everyone else in the newsroom got to see it. So I think it was an eye-opening experience for some people who may not have realized the frustrations of the digital side people or the people who are trying to build new products within the Times around this sort of lack of appreciation and inability to get good ideas translated into reality. So I think internally there have been some tremendously interesting conversations going on. The other piece of it is the New York Times is going to need to continue to learn about what digital publishing is all about. They have a ton of expertise. They, again, produce a really tremendous product. But there's still a lot of things that they're doing that are kind of backwards. And it's going to be very interesting to see how the new leadership and the digital side and the print side, if they recognize the need and those opportunities and move forward. The masthead leaders in the newsroom have said they accept the report, they agree with the report. We'll just have to see if they can turn that into reality.
We will. Josh, thank you so much for your insights today, and I hope we can get you back on in the future.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Josh Benton from Nieman Lab at Harvard. I spoke to him via Skype. This is the Media Report on RN with me, Richard Adie. The Guardian has made a rather better fist of digital than the New York Times. And as part of a plan for world domination, a year ago this week, it launched Guardian Australia, the second of its non-British websites after Guardian US. Guardian Australia's editor is Catherine Viner. She arrived in the country only a few months before launching the site and leaves in less than 2 weeks to take up the corresponding role in New York. So, 1 year in and with not long to go, what has been the toughest challenge?
I think it's been surviving at the beginning with so few staff. We really did start on a shoestring, and I tried to make it look like it was the complete full offering, but it really wasn't at the beginning. There was one news editor, there was one production person, there were just two people in Canberra, not very many reporters. So it was very hairy. We were all working 18-hour days, and it was a sort of sleight of hand to prove that we could exist. And once we existed, then we got more investment and a decent number of staff.
One of the early things you did, really early, I remember, was the multimedia exposition of the Denali bushfire in Tasmania. Why was that so important to you? Because a lot of resources went into that.
I think it was important to us to launch with, to showcase a new digital way of storytelling. So we started with that wish to begin with before we decided which subject to follow. And there was just an interesting story to be told about Denali, because it was a different kind of bushfire. The experts were saying it was a kind of bushfire that was no point in trying to stop. And obviously bushfires being at the heart of the Australian experience, it seemed like an interesting thing to explore. And the family, who the famous photo of the family cowering beneath the boardwalk, they hadn't spoken before. Oprah Winfrey had wanted them to tell their story, but they hadn't told it to her, but they wanted to tell it to the Guardian. So it was a way of getting quite a good story as well. And, you know, this idea of digital storytelling, we've done it in a few different ways. We've done it about the threat to the Great Barrier Reef. We've done it about the sporting rivalry between England and Australia before the double Ashes series. And we've got a great one coming up about the Socceroos. So I think it's just sort of playing with different formats, different sort of visual contexts.
I remember two responses to it. I thought it was terrific. And you later won a Walkley for it.
We did.
But the other thing I thought was that you were really putting down a marker about multimedia storytelling, because it just hadn't been done by a newspaper website before in Australia in that way.
Yeah, we wanted to show that we were bringing something different, that we are digital only. We don't have to worry about a newspaper in Australia. And actually digital allows you to tell stories in different ways and find stories in different ways and do everything differently. And we've tried to do that right from the beginning.
What about the election? How important was that to you?
So at the time, that was the definitely the biggest readership we have, although that's now been superseded by the budget, which is by far the biggest readership we had. We had three of our four biggest days last week. So the election was, it was pretty early after we'd launched, three months after we'd launched, and already on our third Prime Minister by September. But we tried to, again, do things differently. So Catherine Murphy has this live blog, which is just the most brilliant live blog you can get, partly because she has this lovely, witty and knowledgeable voice, but partly because she links to all different sources all over the web. And there is this strange convention in Australian media about not linking to sources other than your own.
That's right. We have this pretense that there is no other media and everybody goes...
Well, a sort of pretense that the digital world doesn't exist,
that's,
I think.
It, yes.
Yeah, which Catherine realises that it does. And I think so. It means you only have to go to one place. We've got this fantastic political editor in Lenore Taylor, who was breaking loads of great stories, doing wonderful analysis. And then we did different things like videos, lots of data journalism, charts, or a podcast. We just tried to just show the kind of breadth of what was happening in all sorts of different ways. And I think the budget, sort of 6-9 months on, shows that even to even greater extent.
Part of that approach, the data journalism, podcasting, the live blog, partly as a kind of reflection of your resources, because you can't be, you're still not comprehensive in the way that, say, the Sydney Morning Herald, even in its reduced circumstances, is. I go to The Guardian pretty much every day, but I always go to the Sydney Morning Herald.
I think we obviously have much smaller resources than the other newspaper websites in Australia by a long way. But a lot of those resources are spent doing stuff for the paper. So they might do stories, but they go up much later, or they're very kind of old-fashioned 850-word, 650-word, 450-word stories for the paper, rather than necessarily starting with something that happened and say, OK, what's the best way to cover this story? If it's a rolling news event, a live blog is the best way to cover it. If it's an audio event, if it's a visual event, then you want a video clip of it. You know, I don't think it is a reflection of resources. We do have fewer resources, but it's about, in the digital world, you start with the idea and then you say, okay, how should we do it? Because there is no paper to serve.
Right. Well, let's talk about the biggest story that you've got, which was the revelations about Australian spying on Indonesian President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono. When did you know that you had such a strong piece?
It was a few days before we ran it.
Because you'd actually had the information, or The Guardian had the information. I think initially it was the New York office, actually. But you'll correct me. For months and months, hadn't you?
So when Edward Snowden leaked the material to Glenn Greenwald and The Guardian, it was kind of an enormous amount of material. I think it hasn't all been looked at.
It hasn't all been looked at yet.
And the New York team was obviously focusing on US stories. And when they came across an Australian story, they told me about it at once.
But that was, what, two months later, or three months later, or even longer?
Yeah, I can't remember, but a long time afterwards. But I jumped on it the minute I could. I mean, it's also quite hard to communicate. We can't communicate in conventional ways because of what we learned from the Snowden revelations, that the NSA is able to look at all of our communications. So we had to communicate in different ways.
Actually, that really got Guardian Australia talked about. And you too. I think at one stage you were pursued by a News Corp photographer.
I was, yeah.
What was that like?
I just wish I'd done my hair better that day.
How much do you think you've achieved in that first year of what you wanted to get done? You must have started with a kind of wish list. Where are you on it?
I mean, I have to say it so far surpassed what we expected. The traffic is probably three times what we thought it would be by now. The commercial plan is 300% over where we thought it would be by now. And we keep adjusting the targets and then smashing them and having to do new targets.
So are you covering your costs in Australia?
That's a good question. I don't know how to answer that, I have to say. Covering your costs?
Yeah. Making the revenue to pay for what you do just in Australia?
I would say we're not there yet, no, but it's much closer than we expected it to be after a year. I mean, you know, we thought that would be much later down the track.
Now, I haven't really, apart from the day you were pursued by a News Corp photographer, I haven't really asked about you, Catherine, because when you're finishing really soon, aren't you?
I'm finishing 9 days' time, yes, heartbroken.
And then you're on the plane to... Are you going home first, or are you going straight to New York?
No, I'm going to London first, yes.
New York is next, though, isn't it?
Yes, I'm going to edit Guardian America.
And it's, in a way, it'll be a similar job, but in a way a very different task, because you're not building it from scratch.
Yes, it already exists. And obviously, I mean, lots of ways, as you say, it's the same, similar, because The Guardian is The Guardian. But there's some different challenges. So the audience is much bigger, but much less loyal than the Australian audience. One of the most thrilling things has been how into us our Australian audience is. The loyalty by which we judge the number of pages they read per visit, or how often they come to the homepage, things like that, is almost as high in Australia per reader as it is in the UK. And as I joke with my London colleagues, they've had a newspaper since 1821, and we've only been going since May last year. So I'm very pleased about that. But in America, it's a more promiscuous audience, but it's a much bigger number. So my job is to kind of make them more loyal to The Guardian, feel more part of The Guardian community, while continuing to break stories and be The Guardian.
You'll have a much bigger team and many more resources as well. It'll be a kind of different managerial challenge, won't it?
Yes. And again, because I think one of the things that's been so enjoyable about Guardian Australia is starting it from scratch. I did arrive on my own and built the team. And that's been one of the most pleasurable things, hiring these big name writers and also some more junior digital journalists, all of whom have more than delivered, you know, on what we expect, what I could have hoped.
Actually, while I'm on New York, I must ask you, what do you make of the leaked report on the New York Times and its struggles with its own culture in becoming a digital media outlet?
Yes, I thought, I mean, the report was very interesting and very revealing about the New York Times rather than about digital challenges facing anyone else. I think there were different struggles from, you know, the New York Times is a thing of its own.
It is.
I would say. It's not really part of the...
It is, but I think it's worth talking about in part because they have tried. They've not been short of resources. We're talking about hundreds of people devoted to the digital side at the Times, and they've done some wonderful things, but they still haven't really pulled it off.
Well, they're the number one quality newspaper website in the world, so I think probably on their terms they feel they've pulled it off. But lots of the things within it, like embedding audience development and analytics into the editorial team, is something we've been doing for many years on The Guardian.
Yes, so, you're actually ahead of them in lots of ways of measuring it. I asked you about your ambitions for Guardian Australia. What about The Guardian Group? Is the plan to become really one of just a handful of global media brands in the English language?
Well, in a way that depends on the other English language media brands, doesn't it? I mean, we are currently third after the New York Times and Mail Online. Mm. Actually, New York Times are second, aren't they? Not first.
Sorry, yeah, I think Mail is the biggest.
Yeah, sorry. That changed a few some months ago. But yes, it's to be a global... this is what I think the launch of Guardian Australia last year and the launch of Guardian America 3 years ago, it's about sort of being having a strong global identity in English language countries or for anybody who wants to read a newspaper website in the English language.
It's still it is a race though, isn't it? It's kind of, can you get this to work before you run out of money? And we've got these converging curves in a way.
Well, and The Guardian famously has recently sold one of its big assets, which means that it has $1 billion in the bank. So I'm not too worried about running out of money right this moment.
As you prepare to leave, what's been your best moment, do you think?
Oh, there's been so many. It's because it has been the most fantastic time of my life, actually. But, I mean, this makes me sound such a dull person, but it was when we left the budget lockup, about an hour after that, and we got up all this amazing content. We'd got all these brilliant news stories. We'd got First Dog on the Moon cartoon. We did the budget in six graphs. We did, you know, What It Means for You. And it was just such totally brilliant output. There was nothing about that budget coverage that I thought we could have done any better. And it felt like a culmination of a year's work, hiring, management, team working together. And so it was just a great moment. But
I
can think of a better one if you give me a bit longer.
What did you do afterwards? Did you go out for a meal? Did you go dancing? Did you go and lie down in the hotel room with a cup of tea?
Well, the thing is, because we're a website, it's live then. You know, it's not like we can just file for the paper and go to the pub like everyone else does on the night of the budget lockup. So we were working till very late, but we did manage to squeeze in a few drinks before the Canberra night spots closed.
And what are you going to miss after you leave?
So I obviously really miss my fantastic team, but I've really enjoyed getting to know Australia, the history, the culture. I'm absolutely obsessed with it now, completely fascinated. I've read so many novels and nonfiction and films, and it's just, I will miss that kind of this fascinating, deeply complicated country.
Well, thank you very much for coming in before you leave.
Thanks, Richard.
Catherine Viner, editor of Guardian Australia and deputy editor of The Guardian. Good luck to her. And even more luck to the 150-odd Channel 10 employees who will lose their jobs tomorrow. Most of them are from the news division, and it isn't the news programming where 10 has a problem. Life isn't fair. That's about it from us. Remember the website, abc.net.au/radionational. Thanks to producer Kyla Slaven and sound engineer Paul Gough. I'm Richard Adie, and Wally Dalley is about to be in your ear.